of all, I'd like to welcome everyone here today to our what it's turned out to be our annual colloquium for the Studies in Comparative Literature and the Arts in our Department of Modern Languages, Literatures, and Cultures. Just to open up very briefly, for those who don't know me, I'm Christina Santos, the Graduate Program Director for the Master's Program. And just a couple of words of inspiration or words that have been inspiring for the work that this interdisciplinary program does here at Brock. It basically is an interdisciplinary study of comparative literature and arts as a discipline that encourages our students to pursue their intellectual and creative interests from beyond traditional categories. Our focus in the program has been to expose students to the richness of dialogue when the webs of interlocution, as stated by Charles Taylor, go beyond linguistic, geographic, political, and national borders. To paraphrase Mario Valdez from our 2011 colloquium, one studies comparative literature and arts because it allows for the freedom of inquiry, a cornerstone to what Northrop Frye considered the development of the educated imagination. Now, I would like to welcome to the podium our Dean of the Faculty of Humanities, Dr. Douglas Neal.
Thank you. Greetings, everyone. On behalf of the Faculty of Humanities, welcome. And a special welcome to our four presenters from the Universities of Alberta and Connecticut and Toronto. I think we have a delightful afternoon and indeed evening ahead of us. Let me begin by recognizing the work that Christina and Corrado have done in putting together today's colloquium. Would you join me in thanking them for their hard work in making this? Now, first of all, I want to note how appropriate today's topic is. Some of you may not know that Brock University is in a UNESCO World Biosphere Reserve, and therefore we are in the lap of this beautiful natural environment, which is to say that we are therefore very, I hesitate to say it, eco-friendly. So it's a wonderful fit. It gets better. It's a great fit for not just for that reason, but for a couple of other reasons. I have two personal echoes of echo, which would therefore sort of make them meta echoes, I guess. And I want to share those with you. The first goes back to Yale University in the 1980s when I was doing my postdoc in Comp Lit with Jeffrey Hartman and Hillis Miller and Harold Bloom and all the rest of the hermeneutical mafia, as they were called back in those days. And one day, Umberto Eco came to Yale to give a talk, and I remember it well. His title was, How Did a Dog Bark in the Middle Ages? And as you can imagine, it was concerned with theories of signs and theories of words, and it was later published as Latratus Canis, or The Dog's Barking. But what I remember most, and I'm not kidding, because it had its own self-reflexive, meta-referential quality to it, was that partway through the talk, the door to the lecture hall opened, and a dog ran in and up to the front of the stage and around a bit and out again. Without missing a beat, Eco looked over the edge of the stage at the exiting dog, and he said, You see, they know when I am coming to town. My second meta-echo is that this past Christmas, I reread Foucault's Pendulum and enjoyed it immensely, all over again. I chose the book, I picked it off my shelf, almost randomly. I mean, I didn't choose it deliberately, as preparation for today's remarks. But then I remembered that in Foucault's pendulum, nothing is random. Everything is connected. Everything has meaning, whether it's mystical or occult or numerological or semiotic. Rereading the book just a few months ago, I found myself agreeing with Anthony Burgess, who, when he reviewed it in the New York Times in 1989, said, "No man should know so much." And I would agree with Belbo, one of the main characters in Foucault's Pendulum, who likes to say, "Ma gavda lanata." Politely translated, it means something like, "It's time for the dean to pull out the cork and let the colloquium begin." Allora, ecco. Let's go.
Thank you very much, Douglas. You should have presented a paper yourself on this. You should have attended our classes. You're very welcome. Okay, I think we should get moving. Our first speaker is Jonathan Hart. He teaches, very modest, there's only two or three lines that he's given us of his CV, but it's quite long. I downloaded it. I don't have time to read it all. But he teaches at the University of Alberta in the departments of English and Comp Lit. And his areas of specialization, I think, are longer than my CV. Just listing the areas: Shakespeare and Renaissance, early modern studies, comparative literature and comparative history, theory and historiography, colonial and postcolonial studies, Canadian culture, early comparative American studies. He has published 15 monographs and books of poetry. I could read you some of them, but it would take too much time. His work, his poetry, I assume, has been translated into Italian and other languages, it says here.
I think so.
No, it actually says Estonian, Slovenian, Chinese, French, Italian, and Polish. He's been Northrop Frye Professor at the University of Toronto and has held visiting appointments at Harvard, Cambridge, Princeton, and the Sorbonne Nouvelle, and elsewhere. So it's my pleasure to invite Jonathan, who is going to talk about Between Story and History, Umberto Eco in Text and Context.
Well, thank you very much for the introduction, and also, I don't see any dogs walking through, but I'll take that as a sign, because it's very true that Umberto Eco was very learned, and I think I said yes to the colloquium before I knew what it was on. I'm delighted to write about Eco, but I do it as a rank amateur compared to any of you. So what I'm going to do a bit is really talk about a little bit about The Name of the Rose, and then about some of his non-fictional work and so on. And I think what I found rather interesting was that Eco himself, a bit like Aristotle, as you'll notice in my paper, makes quite a distinction between history and fiction. He's not sort of a radical constructivist or deconstructionist or anything else. After all, he was a semiotician, and perhaps the moment of structuralism, to some extent, is still with him, even though he's so playful and so delightful in many ways. So this is the amateur beginning to a professional colloquium, and I apologize in advance, but here it goes. When Umberto Eco published his first novel, The Name of the Rose, in 1980, he was already an established scholar and editor. This book, which appeared in English in 1983, is a historical murder mystery set in an Italian monastery in the year 1327. I'm sure you know all this, but I'm going over this because it will relate to my argument, I hope, anyway. This paper is about story and history, text and context, most often in regard to Eco as a critic, theorist, and reader of his own fiction and work generally. Eco's interest in mystery, semiotics, the science of, or study of signs, reading, fiction, biblical exegesis, Aristotle, St. Thomas Aquinas, the Middle Ages, and literary theory are all well known. Rather than going over well-trod ground, I will provide a reading of Eco reading, a critical perspective on Eco's critical theory. And of course, it'll just be a sliver of it, because it would take me quite a while to go through all his work. I'd like to back into my topic by way of The Name of the Rose. And that novel, as you know, William of Baskerville, a Franciscan friar with a name that echoes a novel by Conan Doyle, and his novice, Adso of Melk, make a journey to attend a theological disputation at a Benedictine monastery in the northern part of Italy. The monastery, as they discover upon their arrival, has had a suicide. Over the course of the novel, other monks die in less than clear circumstances. The abbot asks William to investigate the deaths. This is a world in which mysteries are hard to solve. Libraries are as mysterious as they are collections of wisdom. And the carnival of laughter meets the pain of the Inquisition. Like Sherlock Holmes, William of Baskerville uses deduction to solve the mystery. The end of the novel offers a solution and not. And the world laughs at the detective while the detective laughs at the world, in the traditional sense of the murder mystery. Answers do not come as readily in William's world as they do in that of Sherlock Holmes. The mystery is solved in part by mistake, and there seems to be no pattern, just as in the postscript, Eco writes that the rose is so rich in meaning, it has no meaning. William's use of Occam's razor leaves him with a close shave. That was for Douglas, of course. Douglas and I went to school together, so I remember his puns. And having grown up in a household where puns were, you know, the after dessert, I thought I would come up with one myself. As lame as mine was and as brilliant as Douglas's were. William may use Occam's method to find the simplest explanation to explain all the facts, but he does so in the web of Eco's fiction. Eco tells stories within stories, places books within books, and frames the world of the book and the book of the world, providing a solution to the mystery that depends on Aristotle's work on comedy, which survives only in Eco's imagination. Eco weaves history and story together, making the distinction between truth and fiction difficult to discern. In the comic medium of this novel, which developed as much from romance as from epic, Eco calls into question dogma and celebrates a world with laughter. The divine and human comedies represent their own truths. The reader is also a detective in this novel, given the playful use of sources and metafiction. For instance, William of Baskerville echoes the Hound of the Baskerville, and Jorge of Burgos, the blind monk and librarian, seems to allude to the writer Borges, a bibliophile who also went blind. The mysteries in The Name of the Rose may recall other literary as well as religious mysteries, but the hermeneutic danger, like the rose itself, is that it can mean everything and nothing. There are more interpretative perils. Story and history, history and context, blur in this novel. Some of the characters, like the Inquisitor, Bernard Guy, Michael of Sestina, and Ubertino of Casale, are based on historical figures. Some of the dialogue in the Inquisition scene of the novel derives from the historical Bernard Guy's own manual on the Inquisition. There's a slippery relation between the historical figure and the character by that name because they share Guy's words as an author. So here you're getting elision too between character and author, historical figure and character. Thus, Eco also intricates the connection between character and author, who is and is not the character referred to as Uberto of Bologna. Apparently Umberto Eco himself, but now as a character in an earlier period. So you get kind of temporal play as well. The fictions of this historical story also found new ways of representation. The novel was made even more popular in another medium as The Name of the Rose came out in a film in 1986. In what follows, then, I shall discuss some of Eco's nonfiction, critical, theoretical, and otherwise, since the film came out, mostly from about 1992 onward, in order to concentrate on his later period. Though, as you know with Eco, he refers to himself and his earlier work constantly, and that, and Fry did this too, and a lot of people do when they get to be well-known, is they have to sort of recycle and rework, and these two essays are sort of molded together in this one, and you think, well, I think I read that in the book that was just out 2 or 5 years ago, and so on. And I have to admit, probably, if I didn't do a little of that myself, my CD would probably have half a page, and sort of the world would be happier, and the forest and the ecosystem would be more delighted still. All right, the contribution ECHO has made in the past 2 decades or so grows out of, at least in the English-speaking world, his fame from the mid-1980s when the film came out. The fame is not what interests me, but his subject, in a way, what he explores in story and history, text and context, in works that have far less popular appeal than The Name of the Rose and the subsequent film. Sean Connery helped to give a name and a bloom to that rose, but I, in far more obscure ways, would like to shed some light on Echo's own views beyond his earlier works on Aquinas, the Middle Ages, and semiotics. But as I say, he keeps saying, as I said in the book in 1961, so even when you're looking at his later work, it's a bit of a recursive journey. In Interpretation and Overinterpretation, 1992, Echo moves beyond his elaboration of the Peircean notion of unlimited semiosis in the context the interpretation does have criteria, which he set out in A Theory of Semiotics, 1976, The Role of the Reader, 1979, and Semiotics and the Philosophy of Language in 1984. In his exploration of interpretation and history, Echo puts the matter pithily. To say that a text has potentially no end does not mean that every act of interpretation can have a happy end. He does have a value system. He thinks that time is kind of tough on interpretations that don't make sense or aren't necessarily terribly good. So echoing the idea that we do things with words, Echo amplifies his own case. To interpret a text means to explain why these words can do various things and not others through the way they are interpreted. Echo shifts his attention from the intention of the author and the intention of the reader to that of the text and, taking a philological detour, wants to show by delving into the history of interpretation that postmodern thought begins to look very pre-antique. That's so Echo-like, isn't it? Right? As Echo says so many interesting things in this context, I shall limit myself to a few instances germane to the concerns of this paper. Echo likes paradoxes, as Montaigne did, and as I do, stating that the ultimate secret of Hermetic initiation is that everything is secret. There are twists and turns to Echo's analysis, but his observation on language is important, considering the rhetorical turn or return in philosophy in the past century with Nietzsche, Derrida, De Man, and others. Echo says, Hermetic thought transforms the whole world theater into a linguistic phenomenon and at the same time denies language any power to communicate. I think that's really quite a marvelous observation. For Echo, the Hermetic and Gnostic produce what he calls the syndrome of the secret. In this provocative discussion, Echo wishes to find criteria for the limitation of interpretation because although Echo likes paradox, he does not want us stuck in a linguistic paradox. Texts have certain restraints. Some readings are preposterous, so that if we cannot become masters of semiosis, we might be respectful servants. Echo is concerned then with the over-interpretation of texts. He wants to look beyond the use of analogy in Hermetics, semiosis, and the kinds of substitution in the rhetorical tradition. Similitudes can be seen everywhere. Echo explains the problem. Once the mechanism of analogy has been set in motion, there is no guarantee that it will stop. Any of us who have written PhD theses, it's like, okay, my topic, that's the world, and I'm seeing it everywhere. And that sort of one has to be careful that insanity doesn't set in and that one finishes and hands it in and realizes that there's something else out there. And that can be true with any academic research, but I think the PhD thesis has its own special place with that. The image, the concept, the truth that is discovered beneath the veil of similarity will in its turn be seen as a sign of another analogical deferral. Just one analogy after another. It's as if in logic, if you remember studying logic, that the premise leads to a conclusion that already sort of has a premise built into it, and it's just a never-ending deferral. In the Hermetic tradition, in which its semiosis goes too far in suspicious interpretation, as such, suspicious reading does today, that leads us to an excess in interpretation that may make sense with sacred texts, but not with the quasi-sacred texts like Virgil, Rabelais, and Shakespeare. After exploring some examples of over-interpretation, Eco makes his general point. In theory, one can always invent a system that renders otherwise unconnected clues plausible. You can see why I began with the name of the rose and looking for clues and so on. In some ways, that becomes, in a way, a parable for theory. And you'll see at the end of my paper, I work in his view of his own PhD thesis and how that really leads to the name of the rose, a comment that one of his examiners made, right? Okay. So, Eco advocates for a recognition of the hermeneutic circle as a semiotic strategy. Here, the difference between the ideal and actual, the textual, and the existential are part of the discovery. Since the intention of the text is basically to produce a model reader able to make conjectures about it, the initiative of the model reader consists in figuring out a model author that is not the empirical one, and that, in the end, coincides with the intention of the text. So you have the model reader and the model author, not the empirical reader, because they're all too mortal. That's sort of in a post-Lapsarian or post-Augustinian fall that they can't measure up. So you must have a model reader and a model author. Where does that leave the actual or empirical author in relation to the text? Any of us who've written books get a little nervous when the empirical author is killed off too readily. According to Eco, authors know that their work will be subject to what he calls the social treasury, which I loved. That is, the cultural conventions that the language has produced in the very history of the previous interpretations of many texts, comprehending the text that the reader is in the course of reading. So you have, each text is already in a context as you read it. The reader, too, is in his or her own context. One of the key distinctions Eco makes here, and in the role of the reader, is the difference between using and interpreting texts. That is, for personal ends, perhaps parody, and in a way that respects the linguistics and the cultural background of the author and the text. Eco uses the case of the living author, especially of himself, as he discussed in Postscript on the Name of the Rose, and in his reaction to readings of Foucault's Pendulum, both at some length. Clearly, Eco is divided between the empirical and model author and wants to respond to the empirical reader when he or she is not acting like a model reader. Some interpretations are bad, while others might make the author see something he had not beforehand and might help with the interpretation of the text. Eco felt thrills with some reviews or critiques and the opposite with others. Using his logic, we have to ask whether this is relevant or whether it is, as he intimates, between a laboratory experiment rather than in an interpretative essay. So he's saying, which is really interesting, in his essay, I'm really showing you this is like a lab experiment because I never put it in an essay. Well, it's in his essay, of course, so you're thinking, okay. Really, Eco is quite properly appealing to evidence in which he and others access, and he looks at whether a reading or interpretation is plausibly based on the text. The empirical author is, for Eco, less important for the textual strategy the model reader discovers in the text than for the growth of the strategy for the creative process. In other words, we learn about the empirical author to see how he or she creates the work, but that author doesn't necessarily have any authority over the intentions within the text itself. In Eco's Five Moral Pieces, in the Italian 1997 and English 2001, Eco explores various moral perspectives on worldly and otherworldly matters beyond the customary bounds of literature or fiction. So what I'm really doing is saying, what's the moral aspect to Eco? Because we're talking about metafiction and playfulness. And I think he takes his moral function, his ethical function, just as seriously as he does his aesthetic function. In Reflections on War, Eco examines the importance of intellectuals in speaking out against war. They have critical distance, understand ambiguities and nuances, and look ahead and back and are not in the moment as the media are. Eco's conclusion is straightforward. War cannot be justified because in terms of the rights of the species, it is worse than a crime. It is a waste. And that sort of, you know, in a sense, really Eco's ecology without the joke. He's talking about how the planet can't survive war. It makes no sense anymore. In When the Other Appears on the Scene, Eco addresses Carlo Maria Martini, an Italian Jesuit and cardinal who died recently on the 31st of August, 2012, about 15 years after the original exchange, and they discuss the nature of otherness and the transcendent. Eco, who admits his Catholic education until about the age of 22, asks Martini, a liberal clergy and a scholar of textual criticism, to imagine there is no God, and that humans appeared as a blunder in the fate of the cosmos, and that in time, one of the stories humans made and told was of Jesus. In the fullness of time, he has, at a certain point, the religious, moral, and poetic strength to conceive of the model of Christ, of universal love, of forgiveness for enemies, of a life sacrificed that others may be saved. Eco leaves no doubt how remarkable Christ would be as an exemplar in a narrative made in a hostile world in which the otherness of strange peoples and enemies had not been valued much, if at all. If I were a traveler from a distant galaxy and I found myself confronted with a species capable of proposing this model, I love the fact he's still using model in this, I would be filled with admiration for such theogenic energy, and I would judge this wretched and vile species which has committed so many horrors, redeemed if only for the fact that it has managed to wish and to believe that all this is the truth. Thus for Eco, and he asked Martini to imagine, this mystery would be as miraculous as the real presence. And so he argues for a natural ethic that finds common ground with transcendent faith, just as different faiths encounter one another and discover in conflicts that charity and prudence must prevail. In addressing the Senate, this is another piece he's writing, Eco is also concerned with media, and in On the Press, he says quite wryly that in criticizing the press, I have been saying what I intend to say here since the early 60s, mostly in the pages of Italian newspapers and weeklies. A free press is important, and ultimately Eco observes that reading the newspapers is, as Hegel said, like morning prayer. Eco recommends that politicians and the press work together in considered interviews, whose quotations could be checked and endorsed, so that although there would be fewer stories than the newspapers could look beyond the Chamber of Deputies and the Senate to the world in which billions live and whose lives will affect the future of Italian society. So you see how outward-looking some of his nonfiction is. And although it always has that playful element, he's trying to reach a kind of ethical standard. This is, Eco says, an invitation addressed to both the press and the world of politics to look more at the world and less in the mirror. Eco is providing an outward-looking sense of the planet and society, and not a narcissistic one. So to view his own work as a whole, there is a realistic and altruistic dimension that benefits and complements the inward world of fiction and game. Eco also knows how to tell a tale against himself. In 1942, at the age of 10, he won a prize for writing an essay affirming that it was good to die for the glory of Mussolini and the destiny of Italy. Being Echo, with wit and irony, he introduces twists and turns in his own biography and the life of his country in these turbulent years of the war and its aftermath. But, as with so much in the comic vein, this essay makes some serious points about the importance of the resistance as a moral and psychological force, not simply for Italians and Europeans, but for the Americans who were liberating Europe from those who would enact the Holocaust. In setting out the contradictions and multiplicity of fascism in its various forms, thereby complicating the casual lumping of all forms of fascism into a singular and total movement to be abhorred and opposed, Eco provides an anatomy of fascism, or the eternal fascism. It includes a cult of tradition, a rejection of modernism, an irrationalism that relies on action for action's sake, a syncretic view that cannot accept criticism because dissent would mean betrayal, a fear of difference, an appeal to the frustration of the middle classes, a nationalism that is obsessed with conspiracies, a humiliation at the enemy's wealth and power that makes the regime overestimate and underestimate the enemy, a view of life as a perpetual struggle or war, a scorn for the weak, a cult of death, a machismo, a qualitative populism in which the leader pretends to act on behalf of the people whose power he has usurped, and an Orwellian newspeak made up of impoverished diction and basic syntax. So you can see, a bit like New Criticism more than Deconstruction, Eco very much, and if you look at St. Thomas and his analysis of analogy, he likes similitudes, but he warns against the danger of taking them too far. So what he's tried to find is the core of fascism, what might be a fascism that goes across a kind of typology of fascisms into a singular fascism. But all the while showing the ambiguities, the complexities, and the contradictions. So he's quite adept at that. As a child, with the fall of Mussolini, the young Umberto learned about many parties that had been secretly fighting for liberty and about the return of freedom. He warns about the possibility of fascism in new forms, perhaps in civilian clothes, and how, as Franklin Roosevelt warned in 1938, democracy must needs be a force of progress, or else fascism will grow at home. So that, as Eco notes, freedom and liberation are never-ending tasks. Eco closes this speech cum essay with Franco Fortini's haunting poem, which begins on a parapet of the bridge. In the dead we see, and from the dead we grasp freedom. That was my little interpretation of it, so with all apologies to Fortini. In Migration, Tolerance, and the Intolerable, Eco distinguishes between migration, which changes the host culture, and immigration, in which the host culture attempts to assimilate those who move. Eco maintains the most dangerous form of intolerance is precisely that kind that arises in the absence of any doctrine, fueled by elemental drives. Only through education from infancy can this intolerance be fought. Eco argues that in the face of intolerable conduct, we must have the courage to change the rules, laws included. And he says that except for hanging, because he doesn't believe in capital punishment, he thought that the Nuremberg trials did the right thing by actually changing the laws of war and punishing those who lost the war, when kings used to shake hands and so on at the end of it all. He says that Nazism and the Holocaust created a new threshold for the intolerable because they tried to get a consensus on a planetary level concerning this extermination. And they tried to violate conscience and threaten science, culture, and beliefs. Responsibility is the only response to the intolerable, like the Holocaust. Echo returns to the case of Erich Priebke, a former SS officer extradited from Argentina to Italy to stand trial for war crimes, but it was let off owing to the statute of limitations. Echo thinks they should have just changed the law. That the laws were allowed to remain in the case means that we are all responsible and have not yet stood up enough to the intolerable. Echo shows his moral range in this realm of nonfiction. In The Name of the Rose, he displays the intricate relation between history and fiction in a kind of self-referential play. In his fiction and nonfiction, Echo explores the liminal spaces, showing the complexities of myth, the fact and fact in language and culture, and shows the moral as well as aesthetic implications. Do I have about 15 more minutes? Okay. I always say to my students, it's not what you say, it's how long you say it, so I don't want to break my own rules. I'd have to change the laws then, right? In order to juxtapose the impulses in Echo to fiction and nonfiction, I shall concentrate on two of Echo's books that have appeared in English in the past couple of years. Knowing me, I probably concentrate on three books, but if I can't count, forgive me. In Confessions of a Young Novelist, 2011, Umberto Eco says that he considers himself as an academic by profession and as a novelist only an amateur. Nonetheless, he says that he began to write novels in his childhood, which qualifies his joke in the opening paragraph, just above, that he started his career as a novelist just 28 years ago, making the year of composition as opposed to publication to be 2008. His novels were unfinished, and he began to write poetry at 16. He asks what creative writing is, and he says that it's difficult to find an answer. For instance, Galileo was studied in Italian schools for his style. Still, philosophers, scientists, and art critics can say to readers that they misunderstood their texts. But creative writers, while being reasonable readers of their own work and thus able to challenge a far-fetched interpretation, must respect their readers since they've thrown their text into the world like a message in the bottle, so to speak. He likes that image. For Echo, theoretical essays answer a problem or prove a thesis, whereas a novel or poems represent the inconsistency and contradiction of life, and they ask the reader to attempt a solution. Until 1978, Echo says, he felt satisfied as a philosopher and semiotician, but he did write a novel not too unlike what one of the examiners of his doctoral dissertation noticed about his work. It told the story of my research as if it were a detective novel. That's what the examiner said, apparently, of his thesis. And of course, Echo goes out of his way to say that this was not really a criticism, that he was one of the first to talk about Aquinas's aesthetics and so on and so forth. All right, so he says, he tells then the circumstances, the gestation and the writing of The Name of the Rose, and how he came to recognize his ultimate motivation for writing novels. Eventually, I realized the only correct answer was that a certain moment of my life made me feel that I had an urge to do it. Like Thomas Edison, Echo subscribes to genius being mostly perspiration and far less about inspiration. The Name of the Rose took 2 years to write because he had written a dissertation on medieval aesthetics and had studied the Middle Ages after that. The later novels took longer, depending on how familiar he was with the topic beforehand. He says he does a lot of research. He doesn't like those novelists who write for themselves and so on. He says, why don't they just do a grocery list then, you know? Laundry lists are writing for others. Grocery lists are writing for yourself. Maybe he has someone to do his laundry. So, okay. In writing a novel, Echo collects documents, visits places, draws maps, makes portraits, sketches the faces of characters in a state of artistic withdrawal. He elaborates further on this private work of building a world, as he calls it. Nobody knows what I'm doing, not even members of my family. I give the impression of doing a lot of things, but I'm always focused on capturing ideas, images, words for my story. Okay. Narrative subject then dictates the words, but in poetry it is the opposite. The words dictate the subject. Seminal images are there for Eco at the start of his writing of a novel. For instance, the image of a monk being poisoned while reading for the name of the rose. For the seminal image, Eco then imposes some constraints. For instance, the choice of the seven trumpets of the apocalypse as a frame of the succession of events in the name of the rose. Eco admits to using double coding, the concurrent use of intertextual irony and an implicit meta-narrative appeal that is used in postmodernism. But I would also argue used in Rabelais, Shakespeare, and Cervantes as well. In other words, his fiction quotes directly from other texts or refers to them and also comments on his own nature, on its own nature, and speaks directly to the reader. Eco tells how the name of the rose starts by saying how the author discovered a medieval text, an intertextual irony, as the rediscovered manuscript is a convention, and the irony is double and meta-narrative, as the novel says the manuscript was available through a 19th century translation. This allusion, in turn, gestures towards the neo-Gothic novel and Alessandro Manzoni's The Betrothed, a 19th century novel that claims in its opening that it's based on a 17th century source. This double coding shows respect for the intelligence and goodwill of the reader. Eco also addresses fictions as incomplete possible worlds. He states this view plainly. By definition, fictional texts clearly speak of non-existent persons and events, and precisely for this reason they call for the suspension of our disbelief. A little doff of the hat to Coleridge, I think, there. Text and world do bear a relation to the other. Fictional texts never take as their setting a world which is totally different from the one we live in, not even if they are fairy tales or science fiction stories. Historians and novelists can be quite opposite. According to Eco, dealing with historical truth, historians can argue for centuries about whether a certain piece of information is relevant or not. Fictional texts, however, tell us rather precisely which details are relevant for the interpretation of the story, the psychology of the characters, and so on, and which ones are peripheral. Here there is, as in Aristotle's Poetics, a distinction between history and poetry or literature. Each has a different truth. Each is true in a fictional and non-fictional world. Certainly, Eco distinguishes between people and characters. He does not think that anyone can reasonably deny that Adolf Hitler and Anna Karenina are two different kinds of entity, each having a different ontological status. In other words, you can't deny one's a character and one's a person. History is not just another fiction. Eco says that this is not a textualist, that he's not a textualist in the sense that some deconstructionists who think that there are no facts and only interpretations or texts. Having developed a theory of interpretation based on the semiotics of C.S. Peirce, I assume that in order to implement any interpretation, there must be some fact to be interpreted. Hitler was a real human and Anna a character. The one is tested by external empirical legitimacy and the other by internal textual legitimacy. Fictional statements are hard to refute within the internal logic of their texts, so they become a test for the irrefutability of truths. And that's why a lot of language philosophers like to look at fictional texts. Some fictional characters become independent of the text and the possible world in which they were born and circulate in the world as if they were real persons. They might even become models for people. A character, then, is a semiotic object. Characters never change, and owing to the unchanging nature of their actions, they possess certain inalterable qualities. Eco complicates matters by reminding us that the boundaries between legendary heroes, mythical gods, literary characters, and religious entities are often quite imprecise. Fictional characters, like mathematics, have an unchanging nature, and this very inalterability gives them an ethical power. Without naming it, Eco sees a kind of dramatic irony in the relation between characters in their world and people in theirs. Fiction suggests that perhaps our view of the actual world is as imperfect as the view that fictional characters have of their world. Just as Eco compares people and characters, he distinguishes between practical and poetic lists. The one, like a shopping list, is referential and refers to things in the world, whereas the other is open, suggesting an infinity of events, objects, and persons, because the writers suggest something too vast to be recorded or take pleasure in ceaseless enumerations. At one point he says we like lists because we don't like death. Echo then proceeds to elaborate on the rhetoric of lists. Homer's catalog of ships in Book 2 of the Iliad and his description of the shield of Achilles in Book 18 show respectively the infinite and finite form of enumeration. Within the infinite, there is the topos of ineffability. Literature is also full of obsessive collections of things, persons, and places. In the remainder of his long analysis of lists, Echo discusses museums, properties versus essence, excess, chaos, mass media, library catalogs. Echo also relates lists to his practice as a novelist. For instance, of lists of books, he says, I was probably thinking of such lists when I included in the name of the rose an uninterrupted list of books held in the library of the Abbey, to which he adds something that gives a twist to history and fiction. And the fact that I mentioned real books circulating at the time in monastic collections rather than invented titles like the ones Rabelais cites does not alter the impression of prayer, mantra, and litany that a list of books can suggest. From Cervantes to Calvino, a practical list of books can be fictionalized in such a way as to become a realm of desire. Fiction lists like a ship with a history. Echo ends inventing the enemy in other occasional writings with his thoughts on the WikiLeaks scandal, or what Echo calls the false scandal, because it leaked what everybody already knew. That, since the Second World War, embassies had lost their diplomatic role. He says, it's a big surprise, you know. We've known that for, 70 years. It may be, as Echo suggests, that there can be no secret kept in the age of technology and the internet, so that governments will have to revert to earlier technology to maintain secrecy. Echo makes these suggestions in a satirical fashion, but certainly the world is always changing. What seems like prophecy in science fiction occurs. It is hard to know what among the barely imaginable might come into being. There is little or no privacy. What does it mean to be a person? What does that mean for those persons we call the writer and the reader? Is there time and space to be a writer or reader aspiring to be models of authorship and readership while being all too human and empirical? I just have another page. When texts leak from all sides, and it is difficult to know why people conflate story and history in a world of surfaces and open secrets, can there be a way to patience, slow practice, and long contemplation? In other words, Echo has built up skills as a semiotician, theorist, critic, and novelist that are of a high order. And despite his popularity as a novelist, he has made his texts for a considering and considerate reader. The textual intention affords attention beyond the level of delight to that of instruction, although their mutual dance produces a drama of meaning. Echo is not prone to conflate history and fiction despite their intricate relation in the name of the rose. In his theoretical and nonfiction works, Echo works hard to distinguish possible and actual worlds, fiction and history. In this regard, he resembles Aristotle in poetics. Some of the so-called postmodernist moves of metafiction and irony are found in writers like Cervantes and Shakespeare. Metadrama or metatheater, as well as metafiction, may be something postmodernism has taken up but certainly did not invent. Historiographic metafiction for Echo separates history and fiction even as it represents them together in the most intricate way. Echo himself makes sure in his nonfiction, including his work for newspapers and magazines, to stress the moral and the ethical obligation we have to explore and know the world. He admits evidence and science, even if he knows that the state of knowledge about something can change. In a novel, the characters in action are unchangeable and true to their created world, whereas the world is more complicated, and there can be new evidence or means of evaluating that evidence, whether it appears in relation to, it applies to Napoleon, Hitler, Franklin, Roosevelt, or Hillary Clinton. Literary production and reception are not a free-for-all in which there is such an openness that text can be used or interpreted in any which way, and those uses and interpretations will be given equal weight in time. Evidence matters to Eco. Although he thinks interpretation should be open, he knows that authors work hard to make the best choices in their texts and that readers can read as they will, but that some readings will be more enlightening to their author and others. The text may be the locus where author and reader come together, but the text has intentions that the model or perhaps implied reader and model and perhaps implied author and not the mortal empirical incarnations of reader and author try to optimize over time. The empirical author might tell us something about the creative process, and the empirical reader falls short of the model reader and can only aspire or work with other readers, possibly to be a collective model reader, if that doesn't sound too ominous. The world may be leaking, but Eco still maintains a space for careful thought and the great privilege and pleasure of writing and reading. It may be, as he implies, that our freedom as well as our knowledge and wisdom are at stake. Thank you.